Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, still in Brighton, clearing up after the big speech by Keir Starmer. Patrick Maguire will be here to give you everything you need to know about the speech in just a moment. Well, also, and our big thing, we've taken a look back at the debut speeches of previous Labour leaders, so that's coming up. But first, we kick off with today's columnist panel here in Brighton, joined by The Spectator's Isabel Hardman, and from Labour List, it's Sienna Rogers.
So I suppose we should start by talking about Keir Starmer's speech. And in the context of how the conference has gone, how important is it, Sienna? Is it his make or break, as lots of people are suggesting?
Well, his team wouldn't like you to describe it as make or break. As they pointed out yesterday, every single leader speech is described that way. But obviously it is more important than other ones because he has been in post for quite a long time now, 18 months, and yet we haven't heard him actually address a real-life audience properly. So he's got this chance to speak unfiltered to the public. It is really key. The theme of it is sort of, I'm not Corbyn. Although, you know, they claim that it's kind of all outward facing, future looking, all of those kind of phrases. Ultimately, it's all about, I'm not the last leadership. So, how that's received in the party is as important as how it's received, whether it gets through to the country, I think, because there has been endless speculation. I don't know if you two have encountered this as well at conference, I'm sure you have, about who his successor is going to be.
Yeah.
And it's his first conference, his first real life conference, and all anyone is talking about is who's going to be next. That's not great. So he needs to address that.
He has sort of encouraged that by doing all this rule changes about the next leadership election.
That's the thing that, like, even normal people, I'm not suggesting that anyone here is normal, but normal people in the country will be thinking, why have you spent your first party conference arguing about who's going to how you might select your successor, when presumably you're going to win the next election and then be in power for decades to come?
But this is the weird thing, is that when you talk to a lot of the shadow cabinet, they say, this is about 5 years' time, 10 years' time, and you sort of think, well, hang on a second, but the election's in a couple of years' time. So are you all really actually just planning for a much longer period in opposition? Maybe Keir Starmer, and this is something I've heard suggested by opponents and supporters of him, is a sort of Kinnock figure who does the kicking out of the sort of, you know, the militant left, helps to rebuild the party, and then a Tony Blair figure comes along.
And who might that Tony Blair figure be, Sienna?
The Tony Blair figure.
If he's basically tidying up, clearing out, getting the house in order, who is the next generation? And who's impressed during this conference?
Well, the people that have been talked about as potential successors, definitely Wes Streeting.
Wes Streeting comes up all the time.
Has been coming up all the time. Noticed that he was being wined and dined by some Sunday Times journalists last night. he's a big name. And obviously he got a big speech at this conference. And he's really essential to Starmer's operation. He's always put on the media because they think he's their kind of best media performer. And his brief is child poverty. And they think that's absolutely central to their leadership, because of kind of the biggest theme, the policy theme. So definitely Wes. I mean, obviously, Angela Rayner is always talked about. Who knows?
Mainly, you know, by Angela Rayner.
There's been all sorts of complicated tensions within the left around Angela Rayner, Andy McDonald, John McDonnell, all of this kind of stuff. Whether the left can actually unite behind a kind of soft left figure who could now get that 20% of MPs nominations in order to actually reach the ballot in a future leadership contest is the question, I think.
Who's impressed you this week as well?
Look, Angela Rayner has got all of the attention, hasn't she? She's been very effective at prolonging stories about her. She gave a very moving interview to the Times before the conference, and we had the debate about Scum. She's much better at Starmer than Starmer at getting attention. Yeah. And, you know, that is quite important in opposition, because you don't have unlimited attention directed at you. So to be able to seize those moments when people are going to just shine the limelight onto you for a little bit longer than they normally think you deserve is a gift. Now, a lot of people would really disagree with the way that Angela Rayner operates, that calling Tories scum is a way of making our politics even more hostile than it already is, that she speaks in such broad brush terms that it would be very difficult for her to, you know, lead a government. To be fair, we do have someone who does that as our Prime Minister at the moment. So, you know, these things happen.
I think something that a lot of people remark on is Angela Rayner might be a better opposition leader, and Keir Starmer is more suited to being Prime Minister.
Well, that's
not so much opposition leader.
Like he would probably be quite a good permanent secretary in a government department. That sort of sense, and that. But actually, that's not.
Do you mean that as a compliment?
That's quite
Matt.
Insulting.
But that's not. You know, he's a very, you know, efficient, sensible. Yeah, everyone keeps telling me what a good person he is. He's a good man.
Yeah.
But probably not necessarily a good politician. Mm. And actually, like you said, Isabel, seizing those moments, but also just being able to change the weather. Is he going to be able to do something in this speech which gets him on the front pages tomorrow, gets him in the bulletins, and slightly changes the opinion of him? Or is it going to be more of the same, nice man, bit unexciting?
We have been briefed that he's going to go into more detail about his backstory.
And his most personal speech yet is a terrifying sweat.
It really is not something that fills us with thoughts of joy. And, you know, it is interesting to find out someone's hinterland, but we do know his backstory. I think we do all know his backstory. At least those of us who care know his backstory. What we now need is the front story, what he's actually going to do with Britain. And I'm not sure that that's been clear at all from this conference. You know, we've had some policy announcements, but do they set up a dividing line between Labour and the Tories? Are they aimed at setting up a dividing line between this Labour Party under new management and the Corbyn years? It's not clear. They feel like a sort of weird smattering of different things at different front benches.
Quite a lot of the policies they've announced today are actually Corbyn-era ideas, aren't they, Silla?
Yes. I mean, the fair pay agreements one for over the weekend has probably been the biggest policy announced so far. And that is just restating the one, you know, announced at the kind of conference last year and that was talked about then. It was called something different, collective sectoral bargaining. But they relabeled it and re-announced it. So, I mean, I think in terms of hitting the headlines tomorrow, I think everyone's been talking about whether he's going to be heckled. And I know that Momentum have sent out a message to their supporters who are going to be in the hall during his speech this afternoon and told them, do not heckle him. Do not chant about the previous leadership. Those are their instructions. We want you to chant about a £15 an hour minimum wage and your 10 pledges. Because those are the things that Keir Starmer doesn't want to talk about.
That's interesting. So we might not get all Jeremy Corbyn. We might get £15 an hour.
If Momentum has its way, exactly.
That's interesting. So that sounds more like there might be something later.
I think something is being planned. Yeah, they're certainly being encouraged, the left delegates.
This £15 an hour thing, am I right in thinking that they've just tried to rip off the AOC campaign in America for $15.
I think AOC and what Biden is doing and what the US Democrats are doing is very influential on the Labour left. They're constantly comparing what Keir is saying to Biden and saying, look, he's a centrist. He's not even centre-left. He's not even left-wing. And yet he's more radical than you are. Obviously, the leadership team would say, well, he's in government, so he can do that.
Yeah. And also, there's a misunderstanding of how currency works, that $15 is about £11
an hour. Small details, Matt, small details.
What does Keir Starmer do then if they do start shouting £15 an hour or something about his 10 pledges, which doesn't sound like a very coherent chant to me?
Yeah, I'm not sure how that would go, the 10 pledges.
Have they been practising what he does to sort of slap them down?
I haven't got the exclusive on that, but I assume they do have some lines prepared. But Momentum's explanation for why they're instructing them to do these kind of not Jeremy Corbyn chants, but other stuff, is because they're saying they will have prepared lines for
about
the
Jeremy Corbyn
stuff, but not these other things.
To completely throw him off course by asking about pledge number three.
Yeah.
Let's see if he can... looking ahead to the Tory party conference next week, Isabel, how worried do you think the Tories will be about what's got on in Brighton this week?
Not at all. I just don't think that'd be at all worried. Because, look, I mean, the weirdest thing this week was the Tories saying they weren't putting people up for broadcast yesterday, I think it was, because of the long-standing convention that we do not muddle up the airways during our opponent's party conference, which, you know, how nice of them during a fuel crisis, but Labour failed to fill those airwaves. So Labour failed to capitalise on the fuel crisis, which, given Keir Starmer's penchant for jumping all over crises, you think he'd be pretty good at by now, but they've been so muted. I mean, it really has felt like we're in a proper, not so much a bubble as a kind of, I don't know, a kind of Eden Project roof in this conference. The fuel crisis has barely percolated.
Yes. Yeah. Is that your take as well, Sienna?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, it's difficult at conference, right? Because you, like, all the fringe events are organised months and months in advance. I certainly know that. The speeches are about their briefs, which is not necessarily about the fuel crisis. You know, it's difficult to be current at Labour conference, but at the same time, it does seem as if the opportunities they have had, they haven't adapted to what's actually happening at the moment, which, you know, they talk about a cost of living crisis and these kind of general, very general terms, and they'll mention, oh, there's an energy crisis. But in terms of specifics, there's been nothing.
And it does feel a bit like, we've talked about this earlier in the week, you know, I remember at the Tory party conference during the financial crisis, David Cameron sort of stormed the stage and, you know, at an extra speech on the Sunday afternoon to tell the government to get a grip and the Tory party stand ready to do whatever it takes to save the economy. Mm-hmm. And it sort of, it electrified the conference and also stuck them right in the story that everyone's talking about.
Yeah, I think they could have sort of torn things up, actually.
Yeah.
And rather than carrying on a sort of railway track, they could have said, no, this is a national crisis. And I personally think they should have said something like, we want Parliament to be recalled, which the government wouldn't have done. So it would have made the government look a bit rubbish, rather than sort of, oh, let's occasionally mention a fuel crisis and a fringe about electric cars.
Because actually, two years ago here was when the Supreme Court ruling came in on the propagation of Parliament.
We all went home early.
And Jeremy Corbyn came on the stage and did, it was quite a moment, comes on the stage in an unplanned speech and tears into the government and says, we're going back to, you know, Parliament's been recalled, we're going back. And it was like quite a moment rather than, you know, like you said, everything being planned weeks in advance.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that would have been a great move. I like your suggestion. Thanks. Yeah.
They don't listen to me, though. and how damaging do you think all the fuel crisis stuff is for Boris Johnson, Isabel? Because this pattern of industry warning, weeks pass, crisis builds, government finally picks up phone to industry to ask how can we sort it out, and then we all agree it's going to take a while to you know, level out again.
I think one thing which is probably helping ministers in a dreadful way is that a lot of people seem to be blaming their neighbours. So a lot of people are saying, oh, it's my selfish people down the street. Yeah. They aren't key workers. They just want to go and walk their dog and they filled up their tank and all that kind of thing. So there's a sort of diffusing of the blame. But I don't think that's going to last over the coming months because, you know, we've got what's the army on standby, which is like such a Fleet Street term. and it's not actually going to help at all in terms of the, you know, what, 150 lorry drivers from the army versus the shortage of, like, you know, 100,000 HGV drivers in general. So over the next few months, we're going to have other shortages. You know, there's the iron brew shortage, which I know my colleague Katie Balls is very upset about. There's the Greggs shortage. There's been the Haribo shortage. And as we come up to Christmas, we're going to have other shortages. I've got friends who've actually been panic buying for Christmas already, which, you know, I would refuse to do it at any time. But I think as we get closer to Christmas...
But the thing is, they don't think they're panic buying. They think they're being prudent and sensible.
Absolutely.
Other people panic buy.
Absolutely.
I just plan ahead.
I just need a turkey more than you.
Yeah.
But I think it is going to hit people more. And I think if there's a pattern of lots of things that people are very used to picking up from the shelves without thinking, going into shortage, then people are going to start blaming the government because it's going to be just so obvious that, you know, it's not... people stocking up on turkeys. I mean, maybe it is, but I don't think you can keep blaming your neighbours forever.
I think it's interesting, Sienna, that the Boris Johnson battles to save Christmas headlines start earlier and earlier.
Yeah, exactly.
It was at least sort of October, November when we had it last year. And that's proper, crunchy, real-life politics that people care about and they want government to do something to sort it out.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously it does play into this kind of, the main dividing line between this Labour Party and the Tories is competence, according to the Labour leadership, right? He is a serious politician, he's competent, whereas Boris Johnson is a clown, as David Lammy said this morning. That is the kind of distinction that they want to make, and this kind of crisis obviously plays into that.
Do you think it works, though? Because we know this. We know this about Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
He is a creation of panel shows and zip wires and all of that. If the Labour Party genuinely think that saying Boris Johnson is a clown for the next 4 years is going to win the election, that's not going to work, is it?
I think the clown thing doesn't matter as long as Boris Johnson has a really big, clear, strong message and the Labour Party doesn't. If we're in a crisis and he's a clown, then that starts to, you know, have an impact.
Yeah, people are less forgiving of a clown who means they can't get to work and they can't get their special Christmas turkey and so on. I also think there's been a problem with Labour's slogan this week, which is it's stronger future together, for those who've strangely missed it from the message discipline. I'd say the refrain you actually hear from front bench spokespeople the most is, why didn't they plan for this?
Yeah.
Look, if they're going to go on the plan thing, go on the plan thing, go big on it. You know, have some kind of slogan which is something about a plan.
Yeah. Well, and
we're organised or, you know, something like that.
The long-term economic plan, which got more and more long-term and really boring for those of us who had to hear it all the time. But that gave the sense of austerity was not a evil Tories cutting because they love cutting. It was part of a plan. We'd thought it through. Mm. It's going to take a long time. It's going to take longer than we said. So it's a long-term economic plan. But you're right, stronger future together. Together, stronger future. I mean, any one of those were. It's also the font and the way it's stuck on the board is also slightly reminiscent of those letters that dropped off behind Theresa May. I can't remember what it said.
What it said once the letters had fallen off.
That sort of scrabble rearranging of the letters. Isabel Hardman and Fiona Rogers there. Up next, we take a look at Labour leaders making their conference debuts before we dive into Keir Starmer's speech.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
This is the Red Box Podcast. Now, let's take a look back at the history of debut Labour leader speeches. You know, a debut conference speech is a big deal. How do you go about making a success of it? Well, we've been asking delegates here at the conference what they want to see from him.
Just hearing something about the direction of the party, how we are going to be standing up for the people, how we're going to be standing up for business.
I think it's going to be some real vision for what we need to do for our country. It's been the most difficult year we've had in living memory, and coming out the other side of that, we just need a real strong positive vision.
It's a really silly one, but I think just like a platform to run on. Like, I don't think we're that far away from an election. Like, even if we were 18 months away from an election, we've got at least 12 months to run on it, and just our platform.
I think for me it would be about how he's going to unite the party again. That is the biggest thing. We are a fractional party and I really want to see him come out strong.
I'd really welcome hearing from Keir about how he can set the health service in the context of the wider community, so tackling health inequalities, deprivation, the issues that people are living with that lead them to have difficult conditions like heart disease, like mental health problems. These don't come from nowhere. They come from the society that we live in, and I'd really like him to be talking in a really strategic way how he can help people live a better life.
It'd be nice to hear a vision which is going to unify the Labour Party, because at the minute we're deeply divided.
I want to hear that he's listening to young, not just younger members and people in Young Labour, but young people all across the country, whether that's sort of on environmental policy or a lot of economic things. I know young people are very concerned about house prices, university tuition fees. I think he really needs to address the things that young people in society actually want to hear about.
Some commitment, I think, too, as well, you know, because a lot of things have been going on, as you know, and I think a lot of people are getting, you know, sick of it now. And I think clear policies need people in place.
Clear policies, that's what people are looking for here in Brighton. Well, how much is actually riding on this, and what actually makes a good speech? Let's speak to Scarlett Maguire, a former media advisor to the Labour Party, back when they used to win elections. Hi, Scarlett.
Hi.
Nice to have you with us. So, yeah, give us a sense of when you used to advise the Labour Party, and what did you used to tell them?
Well, the whole point is that you're talking, you have multiple audiences, don't you? I mean, that is Keir's problem, is on the one hand, he's got to persuade the people in the conference, which includes the journalists and the commentators, as well as the delegates from the unions, that he's a winner, right? That they really can go with him. And the much more difficult thing is persuading people out there that actually what he's saying has some cut through. And that's incredibly difficult because, you know, you've got to get the journalists who are going to clip the right bits, who are going to say this is a wonderful speech. And I would think that while the conference bubble goes on, I mean, actually, most people in the country are barely aware that there is a Labour Party conference at the moment.
And so
he's got an incredible... Go on.
No, I was going to say, so how do you create that moment, the sort of the fizz or the whatever you call it? It feels like there needs to be a moment which sort of has spines tingling in the hall, but also really punches through people's TV screens when they're watching the news tonight.
I know. And the one that we all remember is Neil Kinnock talking about militant, and a Labour council sending taxis around with redundancy notices. And the problem is what he's got to do that is he's got to not be attacking his own party, but he's got to be attacking the Tories. And actually, it's very, very difficult to get something fresh and new about, you know, how incompetent this government is. So that's what he's got to do, is he's got to get this is what's so ridiculous is because it's not about Keir. It's about the person writing the speech that gets something that absolutely encapsulates how terrible this government is, because that's who he's got to attack. And you don't know when it's going to happen. If you think about Ed Miliband talking about George Osborne budget, and he talked about an omni-shambles, and an omni-shambles was picked up over and over again and has gone down in communications history. So Keir's got an amazingly difficult job of he's got to get out there, persuade people that actually he's really got something to say, at the same time as really fizzing up the conference floor so that the standing ovation, which they will give him, many, they will clap and clap and clap, but that it's real and not just a wish.
And how important is it, because there's been lots of talk when I've been speaking to people in Brighton, there's a slight fear that, a bit like the 13,000-word essay that we got from Keir Starmer last week, if this is a speech sort of written by committee, if it's not written, you know, clearly you'll have a speechwriter to make sure it's sort of properly crafted, he's not been sort of sitting and doing all of his typing himself, but it needs to be very, it needs to be, you know, when you can fake sincerity and all of that, then you've got it made. It needs to feel like this is really what he thinks and what he believes in an authentic way, even if 10, 15 people have all been sort of diddling about in the Google Doc.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, and that is the absolute key that Keir needs to look for, even though he certainly will not be the only, he will not be writing his own speech. There's absolutely no question about it, that there are people who will be piling in, that every single sentence will be gone through, even though, frankly, most of us will not be aware of most of these sentences. And it will have gone through and gone through, and he will have rehearsed it. I mean, he's rehearsing it, you know, in theatres, he's rehearsing it in the hall, to try and get some oomph into every word that he says, so that he's picking it up. And to, on top of that, to do the personal stuff is quite difficult. I mean, particularly, I mean, this is a man who is quite shy, actually, and who's quite private. And to have to make him lay out, you know, look, I am the son of a toolmaker. My mother was always ill and, you know, had a terrible... I was an amazingly brave woman, but, you know, had her legs amputated because of this terrible illness she had. I mean, it's quite an ask. And they're going to make him do it. They're going to make him talk about where he comes from and then the future. And it's trying to make sure that one feels that he absolutely owns it. So, yes, I mean, it'll be a performance, but it'll be a performance, you're absolutely right, that only works if one feels that he's absolutely in it.
Scarlett Maguire, thank you so much for talking us through that. It's absolutely fascinating. Scarlett Maguire, former media advisor to the Labour Party.
On digital radio, on the web, and via the Times Radio app, Matt Chorley on Times Radio.
Morning, nice to have you with us. We're taking a look at how a party leader prepares for their first conference speech. Now, that big first speech is their chance to move the party in the direction they want. It can make or break a conference, it can make or break a leadership. Do they go away with a spring in their step or plotting a leadership challenge? Let's take a look back at some of the maiden speeches of Labour leaders through history and ask what Keir Starmer can learn from them, if he's listening. He's got time to tweak things. Patrick Kidd, the Times diary editor, who's watched plenty of these speeches over the years, joins me. Hi, Patrick.
Hello, Matt. How's the seaside?
It's all right. It's not been bad, actually. It's been a bit blustery, a bit wet and windy at times, but, you know, it's nice to be by the sea, albeit actually stuck in this windowless this windowless conference exhibition area for longer than perhaps I might have liked. So let's dive straight into the archives, Patrick. Let's go all the way back to 1976. James Callaghan, whose speech sought to move Labour on from being a protest movement for the unions into a party of government.
There are many ills and many evils in the condition of our society that have still to be remedied, but we are more. We are now a party of government, a party which has put many of the aspirations of the pioneers on the statute book as the law of our land. I hope what I would like to emerge from it is that the government is willing to tell the people the truth, willing to consult with the party, willing to work with the trade unions and with the people to solve our national problems. That's the philosophy of the social contract. Don't listen to the faint hearts. Have confidence. This Labour movement has the responsibility. Now let it prove that it has the maturity to lead our country and our party to a new future.
So that's Jim Callaghan back in 1976. It all feels strangely familiar, that, Patrick Kidd.
Yes, well, apart from sort of having some oratorical force. There's a rather nice speaking style there of Callaghan. Not much applause. Not. I mean, in the Blair era, you had lots of shorter sentences to try and get people clapping and standing up, well, every other minute, I suppose. But it is a difficult moment. Of course, Callaghan was in government.
That already makes every single word you say just a bit more interesting.
Yeah, the prime ministerial voice sort of comes when you're prime minister, doesn't it?
Yeah, that you talk about, you know, how you get lots of round of applause now. I imagine we'll get plenty of those at Keir Starmer. It's a sort of slight Americanization of our politics. Maybe back in the 1970s, we'll be a bit more British about all of that sort of thing.
Yes, yeah, we didn't want to get carried away. Although Thatcher in 1975, so the year before that, her maiden speech as Tory leader was not only short, and we'll get on to how short speeches are generally better speeches, but it was punctuated almost every sentence. It was the Times reporting on it said that it was like an American political convention. And perhaps the thing for Thatcher then, and for Blair in 1994, and not quite I feel, for Starmer, is that people sense there was a shifting of the sands and that this was a government coming in.
It's just a sort of air of excitement, something in the air. Well, let's go back now to 1983. This is Neil Kinnock giving an impassioned speech at the height of the miners' strike at his first conference during that Thatcher government.
That precondition is unavoidable, total, insurmountable, and it's a precondition, and in this movement we don't want to surmount. It is the precondition that we win a general election. That is the precondition. There are some in our movement who, when I say we must reach out in that fashion, accuse me of an obsession with electoral politics. There is no need in this task to surrender our socialism. There's no need to abandon or even try to hide. I remind you, every one of you, of something that every single one of you said in the desperate days before June the 9th, 1983. You said to each other on the streets. You said to each other in the cars rushing around. You said to each other in the committee rooms. Elections are not won in weeks. They are won in years. That's what you said to each other. That's what you've got to remember. Not future weeks.
I mean, that's powerful stuff, Patrick Kidd.
It is, and he also has some very good flourishes in that, the repetition of phrases. There's a lovely bit from the same speech where he talks through the Tory disasters, and it begins, "This was the year when tax was introduced on fish and chips. This was the year when farmers slaughtered milk cows. This was the year when old age pensioners were charged for their spectacles," and builds up and builds up. And that's how you get the audience going. I mean, just as a matter of sort of polish and flourish, having a phrase that you cling on to. And that's what Blair was very good, and unfortunately other leaders have been less good at sort of taking the audience with you through the speech.
Does it make any difference that, you know, Neil Kinnock was just a much more animated, passionate public speaker? If Keir Starmer came out and tried to do that sort of thing, would we think he'd gone a bit, you know, if he'd been... drama trained to come out and just shout everything, just shout, repeat phrases and shout everything. We'd think that was a bit weird, wouldn't we?
We would think that that's weird, but sometimes you can also use the same tactics but by dialing it down. Tony Blair was quite good at doing call and response. I don't know when we'll get onto his, but he threw back at the Margaret Thatcher speech on coming into government, the Francis of Assisi line about where there is... X, Y, and Z.
Discord.
Where there is, yes. And he said, did she bring it? So I'm just trying to find in my notes. Yes, here we are. Where there was discord, is there harmony? They said no. Where there was error, is there truth? They cried no. And he worked through that. And you're suddenly bringing the audience with you. I think you can do that even if you're not a particularly dramatic speaker. You just need a theme and a way of keeping them awake.
Well, in fact, we can take a listen now to that first party conference speech by Tony Blair in 1994, when he was trying to unite the conference around New Labour by taking his fight to the Tories.
And just look at Britain. 15 years after Margaret Thatcher stood on the steps of Downing Street. Do you remember that? Where there was discord, is there harmony? Where there was error, is there truth? Where there was doubt, is there faith? Where there was despair, is there hope? Harmony, when crime has more than doubled. Truth, when they won an election on lies about us and lies about what they would do.
I mean, it was even better than when you did it, Patrick. but what's interesting there is it's all to a purpose.
Yes.
It's not just a clever line. He's communicating a message. There's a bit of humour, a bit of call and response, a bit of dramatic delivery. But in order to communicate a key message, the Tories are rubbish and we'll be better than that.
Yeah, I mean, he had momentum behind him. So in the very first paragraph of that speech, he begins by saying, "We meet in a spirit of hope. I set out my vision." That year, Labour had won 4 by-elections. They'd had very good council elections. Starmer doesn't have that coming behind him. It's obviously he's lost in Hartlepool. He did not know all that well in the local elections. And of course, although we're saying this is his first Labour conference speech, he actually did give one last year in an empty arts centre in Doncaster, which is a bit like being at the Lib Dem conference, I'd imagine. But this is the first time he's got an audience. And so therefore, he's had now a year and a half. And last year he said, I didn't go into politics to be in opposition. The trouble is he hasn't built up the case over the last 18 months that he is a winner. So that's a challenge, because Blair could stand. Blair looked messianic. If you watch the video on YouTube, he looks young. He's in prime BAM. They all look young, by the way. It's on. If you look behind, Gordon Brown is almost looking sexy. You've got even Prescott. Prescott looks young. And Blair is sort of looking up at the heavens. There's a sort of destiny thing there. That's not going to work for Starmer. I do sometimes wonder if Starmer's best tactic is just to bring out one of the donkeys that his mother used to save. Listen, let me save ride you it. Like this donkey.
He should ride it onto the stage with a Kiss Me Quick hat on. Well, as you mentioned, it's not a phrase I thought I was going to use this morning, sexy Gordon Brown. Let's take a listen to him in 2007.
And like so many people across this country, I have the best of reasons to believe in the life-saving power of the NHS and the liberating power of education, and for making them both the best they can be. So this is my pledge to the British people. I will not let you down. I will stand up for our schools and hospitals. I will stand up for British values. I will stand up for a strong Britain. And I will always stand up for you.
Quite a lot of the things we've been talking about there, Patrick, with the, you know, the repetition of the phrase, the building of the momentum, really landing that round of applause. And actually a reminder that despite what happened in the election 2010, Gordon Brown was quite good at this stuff when he really, you know, when he really went for it.
He was good. His difficulty, of course, was that he became leader after 10 years in government. And so you have to defend your record while attacking the chances opposite. He also, you mentioned about Neil Kinnock speaking in the middle of the miners' strike. Brown spoke in a time of turmoil. We'd had three terrorist attacks, Glasgow airport and two car bombs in London, flooding and foot and mouth. And what was fascinating is he began it by addressing these, this omni-shambles, we might call it today, and saying that what it had shown was the resilience of the British people to get through. Now, I don't think that will work for Starmer to come out and say, you know, we're all doing marvellously, it's not as bad as you think. But perhaps by if he begins by saying it's been an awful year and the government has made it worse, but I want to salute the people for coming through this and we will get through, that might work for him.
It's interesting. That was sort of the line he was trying to walk, I think, in his essay last week, was, you know, isn't the country awful, but actually do we all pull together during the pandemic and it showed Britain that it's best. And it's a very difficult thing for the opposition. You don't want to look like you're just talking everything down, but also you can't go around saying everything's marvellous, because good for the government. It's
you
good
need
for
to
the
say
government.
That the people are marvellous, but the country is being
exactly.
badly let.
Yeah, the people have been let down by the government. We've still got, because the Labour Party gets through them, we've still got a couple more to get through. Let's take a listen to, this is back in 2010, Ed Miliband trying to make the Labour Party the party of optimism.
We are the optimists in politics today. So let's be humble about our past. Let's understand the need to change. Let's inspire people with our vision of the good society. Let the message go out. A new generation has taken charge of Labour. Optimistic about our country. Optimistic about our world. Optimistic about the power of politics. We are the optimists, and together we will change Britain. Thank you very much.
Now, I remember that speech at the time, Patrick, and I'm not sure it quite hung together in the same way. The just saying optimism over and over again in slightly different formulations.
Well, exactly. It's very hard after 13 years to try and pretend that you're new. That phrase he said, "We are the new generation," just made me think of the old Pepsi advertising campaign. We are, and the trouble is, the nation preferred Coca Cameron, who looked even more new and shiny. So, I mean, I think he was optimistic in thinking that optimism would win the day. I'm not sure quite what else. A bit like William Hague in 97, to some extent you need to take your kicking. But you have to admit after losing an election that mistakes are made. And it's not sackcloth and ashes, but you can't go in saying I'm a winner when you've probably just lost.
Yeah. Which brings us to the last of the recent Labour leaders to give their debut speech. This is in 2015. Jeremy Corbyn used a Maya Angelou quote to call for a kinder, gentler politics.
There's another important thing about how we're going to do this. It's a vital part of our new politics. I want to repeat what I said at the start of the leadership election. I do not believe in personal abuse of any sort. Treat people with respect. Treat people as you wish to be treated yourself. Listen to their views. Agree or disagree, but have that debate. There's going to be no rudeness from me. Maya Angelou, brilliant writer, said this. You may not control all the events that happen to you, but you can decide not to be reduced by them. Wonderful words from Maya Angelou.
That was Jeremy Corbyn back in 2015 calling for a kinder, gentler politics. I'm not sure it quite worked out like that, Patrick Kidd, in the end.
It didn't, but the biggest problem actually with Corbyn's first speech, because there was nice sentiments and he tried to build bridges. Bear in mind, at the time, his shadow cabinet included Hillary Benn and people like that. It hadn't all started to fall apart. It was so long. I wrote in the sketch I did at the time that when you left the hall, you were surprised it was still daylight outside. I've printed out the various speeches by the Labour leaders. And Brown's was 8 pages long. Blair's was 6. Corbyn's went on for 15. And it's...
Wow.
And the trouble is, you are going to lose... At one point, he started going about Saudi Arabia, which I'm not really sure is what you need in your first leader speech, and Syria. But it was genuine. It was kind of gentle. The slogan he campaigned under was "Street Talking, Honest Politics." So just a bit less of it was probably what was needed.
And, of course, also in that, you know, because he hadn't done a lot of sort of big podium speeches, he did struggle a bit with the auto-cue, including reading out at one point, "Strong message here,"
yes,
which was a note from the auto-cue rather than something that he needed to read out.
That's something to avoid, and we may discuss next week Tory first speeches, but Margaret Thatcher's, who, as I said, was 41 minutes, quite nice, short, punchy, good oratory, she'd written on the top, you can see this in the Thatcher archive, the words... "Relax, low-speaking voice, not too slow." Now, if Starmer comes out in half an hour and just says, "Relax, low-speaking voice, not too slow," maybe that's all we want, and then sits down, brings out a donkey at that point, then we might all be happy. But yes, don't read out your stage instructions. Don't be too long. Don't try to be who you're not, and give them something to cheer.
So that's previous Labour leaders, but how did Keir Starmer actually get on? No sooner had he walked off the stage, I caught up with Patrick Maguire, Red Box editor, to get his take on the big make-or-break speech. Keir Starmer delivered his first in-person conference speech of his leadership in Brighton. He said his focus was on work and family, but did this make-or-break speech work? And is Labour now a happy family? I'm joined by Patrick Maguire, Times Red Box editor. Patrick, in a moment we'll talk about some of the Labour Party stuff, but one of the big criticisms of Keir Starmer is that so far he hadn't really inserted himself into the other big story of the week, which is petrol, the fuel crisis, and he did that right from the get-go.
Yes, right from the off. Every news bulletin tonight will carry, by Keir Starmer standards, quite a nifty and on-the-pulse joke saying, you know, in this country, you can't even fill up, so how do we expect the government to level up? Which, you know, as you say, not often Keir Starmer inserts himself so deftly into the big story of the day, and even more difficult given that these speeches are addresses to the party faithful. So he started off very strongly there.
If you go outside and walk along the seafront, it won't be long before you get to a petrol station that's got no fuel. Why do we suddenly have a shortage of HGV drivers? Why is there no plan in place? A tank of fuel already costs £10 more than it did at the start of the year. Gas and electricity bills up. Gaps in the supermarket shelves. Rent up, especially for those on the lowest incomes. Yet this is the very moment the government is putting up tax on working people, putting up tax on small business, and shamefully slashing universal credit, the lifeline for 6 million families. We have a fuel crisis, a pay crisis, a goods crisis, and a cost of living crisis, all at the same time. Prime Minister, either get a grip or get out of the way and let us step up and clear up this mess.
Another big test for Keir Starmer was his ability to properly take the fight to Boris Johnson. There's been this criticism, particularly during the pandemic, where for understandable reasons, he was reluctant to be seen to be criticising the government. But again, he managed to step up. There's some colourful language, some decent jokes.
Yeah, in the first half of the speech, we got the personal story of Keir Starmer, and it was all intended to draw out his qualities as a, you know, to borrow a phrase Boris Johnson likes to use, an oven-ready prime minister. There were lots of comparisons with his perceived seriousness with Boris Johnson's. In his words, you know, he's not a bad man, he's a trivial man. And it's that, again, it's that competence framing Sir Keir Starmer uses again and again and again. You know, again, uncharacteristically flippant, frivolous from Keir Starmer was, he mentioned, as we've heard many times before, his dad being a toolmaker, quipped that Boris Johnson's dad might be worthy of the same title.
Conference, it's easy to comfort yourself that your opponents are bad people. I don't think Boris Johnson is a bad man. I think he's a trivial man. I think he's a showman. He's a showman with nothing left to show. He's a trickster who's performed his one trick. Once he'd said the words, get Brexit done, his plan ran out.
But let's focus on the Labour Party then, because previously when he ran for the Labour leader, Keir Starmer's focus was on unity, bringing the Labour Party back together again. We were told before the speech that he was putting it out to one side. It wasn't about unity anymore, it was about putting his mark on the party. And strikingly, he was very critical of the last Labour manifesto, which was put to the country, and then got big applause for praising the governments of Tony Blair and Gordon Brown.
Yeah, interestingly though, the only one of the... So there were three figures who loomed large over this speech. One was Jeremy Corbyn, not mentioned by name, but as you said, again and again and again, Keir Starmer returned to the themes of credibility, talking about government in action rather than sloganeering. Yes, saying, you know, he even tied his criticism of the Tories into the quality of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. You know, in his peroration, he was talking about, you know, well, not quite his peroration, one of many perorations, he said, if we couldn't even beat this shower of Muppets, what does it, not that he used those words, what does that say about us? Tony Blair, again, didn't mention Tony Blair by name, because that is a recipe for, you know, setting this hall alight. But he did staunchly, interesting, without the caveats that you hear from past Labour leaders like Ed Miliband. There was no criticism of New Labour. He embraced New Labour's domestic record as a good thing.
There was no need to say, oh, by the way, Iraq.
Yes.
There was a total focus on minimum wage, improving schools, improving public services.
And as much as Keir Starmer is often likened to sort of an Ed Miliband redux, that's a really significant difference. And it's the first time since 2010 any Labour leader has really done that. He gave a long list of New Labour's achievements that was very reminiscent of the Gordon Brown's last stand at the party conference in 2010, when he... I have to admit, the oratory wasn't quite as good. When Gordon Brown listed the achievements of the Labour government, Keir Starmer consciously imitated that.
It wasn't all happy families, though. Right from quite early on, the speech was marked by heckling.
This is a... At this time on a Wednesday, it's normally the Tories that are heckling me. Doesn't bother me then. Won't bother me now. So, you see... Shouting slogans or changing lives conference.
Now, normally a party leader would never want to be heckled at during their speech. They want to deliver their speech and have control of it. But not only were they prepared for it, there's a sense that Team Starmer are probably quite pleased about how it panned out.
Yeah, there are two theories here. The first is that, as you say, Keir Starmer's team will be delighted because the heckles, which I have to say, you know, often these things are likened to Neil Kinnock's speech in 1985, where you have members of the militant tendency in the crowd heckling him. You know, Derek Hatton and Eric Heffer, prominent Liverpudlian politicians. This time, you had a former Big Brother contestant, lots of quite eccentric, shall we say, grassroots activists talking about everything from the £15 minimum wage to later on freeing Julian Assange. It wasn't quite the battle for the soul of the Labour Party that we've seen in previous years. And Keir Starmer, in response, could reinforce all of the themes he was trying to draw out in the speech. And I'm sure, actually, when we see and hear these things on the bulletins, it will be the responses to the heckles. You know, changing lives, not shouting slogans. He even referenced the, you know, said at this time on Wednesday, it's usually the Tories who are heckling me, which is a nice needling line. But the second thing is, it's worth remembering, you have low-level heckling throughout this speech. Keir Starmer handled it very well, but it was a little bit chaotic. And it reminded me of something a shadow cabinet minister said to me yesterday, which was, I asked them, do you think Keir should take on the left and have his Kinnock moment? They said, people forget that Kinnock's ratings went up after he gave that speech because people saw a strong leader. But the Labour Party's ratings went down because they saw a party in chaos. Now, interestingly, whether the difference is that actually the public see that this is a few grassroots characters rather than people at the top of the party will be the interesting difference.
So finally, the fifth big takeaway from this, I suppose, is his focus on family, talking about his mother being a nurse and then being cared for by the NHS, talking about his father as a toolmaker, and the values that that instills in him.
When she was young, she was diagnosed with Still's disease. It's a rare form of inflammatory arthritis which severely restricts mobility. This disease, along with the drugs she had to take to control it, took a very heavy toll. The NHS, that had been her livelihood, became her lifeline.
All of those themes that he wanted to hammer home, he did bring together in it. It was an extraordinarily long 90-minute speech. But it, on the whole, I think he'd be pretty happy with how it went.
Yes, I think so. And as he said at the very beginning, the two cornerstones, the two rocks of his identity, what got him into politics and what sustained him in politics, are family and work. It has to be said, by the hour mark, we were into robotic exoskeletons and undersea wind turbines. But he returns to that in the peroration, family and work. And that is, those are the two frames that Labour strategists think are the most effective way of framing Labour's message, the party of security, be that in work, be that in the home, or through life, Labour providing. And I think Keir Starmer, as much as we have had to sit through 90 minutes of occasionally sort of futurist techno babble and dad jokes and sort of slightly clumsy literary allusions, I think that framework he managed to hammer home quite effectively.
Just finally, lots of people said it was make or break. He was focusing on work and security and so on. He's more secure in his job now than before he started the speech.
Another thing another shadow cabinet minister said to me earlier this week was, if this goes badly, all bets are off. It clearly didn't go badly. What people around Keir Starmer, and indeed what Keir Starmer knew he needed to do on his own terms, he succeeded earlier in the week in getting the Labour rule changes through. He had to communicate that same sort of message, i.e. this party has changed, its focus is now the country, not its internal affairs, and we are ready to govern and we compare favourably to the Conservative Party. Those are all things I'd say Keir Starmer communicated. Whether the public will look at him and say you did so with enough conviction, whether it feels much affection for him, are all unanswered questions. But on its own terms, regardless of how tedious it was for us hacks at points, I think it broadly succeeded.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.